Episode are we on?
I don't know, man.
Welcome to the Memory Core. I'm Dan. That's Adam.
This is like, what, episode 6 or 7?
Something like that. I'm too lazy to look it up right now.
Yeah, it's been a while. I know we uploaded some stuff on Making Hex Spaces, but yeah.
Yep. I put up the follow-up video today, actually.
Cool. I mean, hopefully we'll get some hits. For those of you who aren't aware or just coming across this now, and basically the idea is using simple geometry to make a hex space. Because you think about it, you try to make a hex space, you're trying to make a hex, like a hexagon by hand using like a protractor. Because, I mean, I don't remember being taught in school how to use a compass or a pair of dividers. This is all stuff I've learned recently through, you know, woodworking and things like that. You pull out a protractor and try and draw it out, and you can do that okay, but you'll be actually much more accurate using, you know, compass or dividers and a really sharp pencil. You're probably within a thousandth of an inch if you take your time and you do it well. So using that to make hex spaces for mechs. So yeah.
And I'm not good at taking my time.
Well, yeah. Well, I mean, Dan. I don't know if you want to kind of go into detail about sort of your idea. Mine was more like taking this concept and sort of making maybe like a premium base for a miniature. I mean, you know, for me, like I am totally on board with spending all the money to get hex bases from Iron Wind. I mean, whether it's supporting the company, whether it is the weight of the pewter base so that it keeps the miniature standing upright. And that's really huge. And also, like, you know, hey, I mean, for people out there who use like a circular base or something like that, like that's fine. I mean, you do you, but it is kind of annoying looking at that and being like, but I don't know necessarily which way exactly the mech is facing. Like, it seems like it'd be really easy to fluff things. Especially for mechs that are more dynamically posed, if you've got a circular base. Like, it's not technically legal for the game. I mean, like, supporting Iron Wind, you know, over a plastic hex base because, you know, it's lightweight. Your mech will probably tip over much more easily. But I just kind of had this idea of, like, what if you got, like, a nice piece of cherry or walnut or quarter sawn oak and, you know, had a mech that was just on that, like no terrain basing, just like the wood and a painted mech. It's just sort of an idea I was bouncing around my head. But you know, Dan, you had something else that you were planning.
Yeah. So the bases I had, I mean, obviously we've already mentioned this probably 1,000 times about where we've started getting into the game, and the boxes that we had growing up only had paper counters in them. So we pretty much took that idea, and what I wanted to do was, because the hard part with paper counters is you can't really determine, kind of like when you were talking about the round hex base, it's really hard to determine facing, and obviously they blow over pretty easily, or fall down pretty easily. So, yeah, just making a wooden hex base for them, leaving a slot in the front of the hex base for a movement die, since that was something that was added to the game. Well, I mean, it's always been something that was there, but it, you know, now it's actually like an official part of the game. And then on the wood bases themselves, in each arc, or each side, I should say, there's a Roman numeral that corresponds with the facing after a fall table. So the idea was to make something like this for paper miniatures, I'll call them miniatures because that's how they always felt for me. But like our paper miniatures, so you could determine facing and all of that. And the other thing is like, you know, I'm a fan of Alpha Strike. Being able to use them in that setting and being able to do things like base-to-base contact and determining like what cover, you know, because they get pretty detailed with cover in it too. Now, given they're flat, so that doesn't really help too much, but, you know, you could take, like, the top, like, the clear part of a Chess X dice case and slap it over the thing, and you could determine it that way too, you know?
Well, right, because the Alpha Strike book, it does have sort of like templates that you can print out for roughly the size of a battle mech, right, for determining...
Yeah, which is basically the size of the hex base. So, like, yeah. Even if you're determining, like, vertically it would be kind of hard, but, like, if... No, I think I got it messed up. Horizontally would be kind of hard. Like, if you're standing above it and you can't see the hex base, that's what you would use that template for. But vertically, like, if you're, like, half of your mech, like, from the top part of it to the bottom is, like, covered, you can determine that from the actual hex base.
Mm-hmm.
It, you know, because miniatures in Battletech were never really about scale. You know, they were just more about being able to put them on a hex board and looking nice.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I kind of do want to push back against that a little bit, although you're not wrong. But this is my view on, like, the miniatures. I think this kind of goes back to some of the comments we've seen previously. And, you know, when the game first started producing miniatures, I mean, they were pretty rough and low detailed. But then around, I think, was it 87? I got a Thunderbolt Unseen here that's been tipped over. There's
like
a yeah, like sort of 86, 87, 88. You've got these miniatures being produced for the first time, and it was a small group of artists, and they all seem pretty consistent in size. Like, I will say that, like, because I have, I think, pretty much every mech from the original 3025 TRO, and they all stack up pretty nicely next to each other, from lights up to assaults. Like, they all look pretty good. And then with 3050, you've got, you know, 2750, and then 3050, you've got, you know, the Star League mechs and the Clan mechs, and a couple of the new Inner Sphere ones, and you start to get a little bit wonkier. But then I think with 3055 and 58, it starts to get a little more flexible, but I think things could really go out the window when Ral Partha and then Iron Wind had, like, the huge dip in quality control in the early 2000s, because, and there are a number of reasons for that, and whether or not, like, they're okay, there are still problems with it. So I think I will push back on the scale issue from at least the first round of miniatures, or, like, I guess maybe you would say, like, the second generation in the late 80s, I think they're okay.
Well, I wonder if it had to do with the transition from lead to pewter, do you think? Does it really make that much of a difference?
I don't necessarily think it makes that much of a difference. I mean, I think you'd have to pull out the, I don't know what the shrink coefficients are for, like, lead pewter versus lead-free pewter. That's one of the main reasons why miniatures shrink from the masters, is because, you know, the masters go in the mold, and then you're pouring hot metal into the molds, and then as they cool and solidify their shrinkage, they pull away from the mold. I think it's more like there was just sort of wonky quality control coming from Iron Wind that I think they've mostly fixed. But yeah, I mean, I think that'd be one of those things that'd be really worth doing. We'd be going through my collection and, like, posting comparison photos and seeing how all these miniatures line up next to each other. And, you know, short of, like, the Griffin and Shadowhawk, where the feet are splayed and maybe they go beyond the hex base, I think they all do look, they all work together pretty well.
Yeah, there's a lot of consistencies between them in the early sculpts.
Yeah, you know, but, like, when, first, you're right, but, like, you're right, like, once you get past that, like, it gets really, like, you know, here there be dragons. It's really weird.
The early clan sculpts had consistencies too.
Oh yeah, well yeah, they did. And because it was, again, it was all done by, like, sort of the same artist. And when they did the 2000 resculpts, that was, I think, one of the first times Iron Wind was working with CAD for Masters. And the original Thor/Summoner and Loki/Hellbringer sculpts stood maybe a little bit too tall because the legs were so large. And then they ended up shrinking the legs down, but kept the torso and arms the same size. But Chris Lewis, who did the artwork, did point out, like, look, this is accurate based on the orthos that was provided in the original TRO 3050. But when it came to the actual tabletop, it didn't look right. So they did adjust that.
The summoner was supposed to be a really tall mech anyway.
It was. And the summoner and the Hellbringer had the same leg design. So they just carried it over like no sweat, but it just ended up not working. So yeah, I think I have that first production run, the Hellbringer and Summoner. I haven't painted them. It's been like 20 fucking years, but I haven't painted them.
The struggle is real.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you know, hey man, I mean, like, you would think with COVID we'd all have time, but you know, I've been busy at work, and it's not just people being stuck at home looking at their dog too long, thinking something's wrong with the dog. We got to take it into the vet. And, like, we had a lot of really sick patients, so I've been really busy, which is good. I mean, I shouldn't really complain about that because I know, hey, I mean, the bottom could fall out at any moment. You know, it can definitely be a thing. But
yeah, I've been staying pretty busy too. You know, a lot of the protests going on, so banks were broken into, and you know, stores, and I've been doing nothing but dealing with, you know, like vandalized ATMs I have to break into, and vandalized safes that have like handles missing, and all kinds of stuff, man. So needless to say, I've been very tired lately. But you know, there's something therapeutic about making a bunch of wooden hex bases opposed to painting like the 10 pewter miniatures and some of these plastics that I have that are probably going to sit on the shelf forever too.
yeah well it, you know it's it, I mean it is nice having something like that you can look at and reference, and everyone's sort of on the same board about, you know, what's going on with what facing things are. It's nice too, because they're less likely to tip over. And the little plastic, you know, stand-ups that come with the miniatures, I mean, they're like, you know, less than a stiff yeah. breeze, you know, like a gentle caress from,
well, some of them that I have, they even break easily. Like, they become brittle over time.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
Yeah. They have to figure out something for it.
Yeah, well, that's one of those things I wonder what will happen with, maybe it doesn't really matter, you know, with the plastic miniatures in the long run, right? Because who's still going to be playing the game in 30, 40 years? But, you know, plastics do get brittle, you know, heat messes with them. So, yeah, we'll have to see how that goes down. Yeah, I mean, hey, you know, BattleTech, right? I mean, with COVID, it's sort of like, yeah, I get why. You know, when there was an outbreak on a world in BattleTech, they would just quarantine the whole planet, or they just nuke the whole thing from orbit.
Yeah, you know? Smoke Jaguar method.
You know, just, you're like, well, didn't the Snow Ravens do that, or the Draconis Combine? They're just like, forget it. Just with the warship.
Was it like a recent thing? Because I know they did it in, not the Snow Ravens, but the Jaguars did it in the invasion. But that was more of a, these people aren't listening to us. We should make an example out of them.
Oh, yeah, I think it was in the Jihad. There was some, I think from one of the hidden worlds or something like that, some nasty outbreak of some genetically modified, you know, virus, and it just, they didn't want to deal with it. Right now, I mean, it's like,
we're not trying to say we should destroy the entire world.
Well, maybe Florida.
Well, yeah.
Just kidding. If there's anyone listening in Florida, and probably not, because like we have like what, 2 subscribers. If anyone's listening in Florida, I don't mean it. We're just talking.
Hey,
shit.
We're getting close to 100 subscribers, man.
Oh, cool. We might get to a point where we make 1 cent from YouTube.
Right.
Although we swear so much, we'd probably get demonetized. So
yeah, probably.
Whatever.
Well, that's why I'm making these hack spaces, Adam. I could figure out how to mass produce them, and we could slap a memory core logo on the bottom of them, and life will be good. We'll be rolling in all the cash.
Yeah. Yeah. Sure. you know, actually trying to talk about, you know, a little bit of BattleTech. I mean, I don't know if you saw, but The Kickstarter was showing there were some delays in production. I don't know if you got that email, Dan.
No, I saw it.
Suppose, I mean, I can't really be surprised.
It's like typical, though, with Catalyst. I'm not even saying that in like a mean way. It's just you come to expect it. Now, there's always some kind of delay when it comes to Battle. The longtime fans like us who read that email are just kind of like, meh, with the newcomers.
Right. But, you know, I mean, for Catalyst, too, you know, a lot of it, you know, they're freelancers. So it's not like they're doing the job, you know, 8 hours a day. So it does kind of gets done when it gets done. It may not be the most, like, healthy thing for the company because new products means more money, which means more funds to put back into products. But, like, you know, with the Kickstarter, a lot of it's already been paid for. So it's a different problem, but it seems to be an issue with the Chinese factory.
Yeah, it's not like they could, you know, predict a pandemic was going to happen this year when they put
Well, I mean, Kettles even said, hey, you know, this isn't, you know, it's not really our fault. It's the company that, you know, the Chinese company's fault. And I get it. Like, they want to stick with them because that company does do good work. You know,
their plastics do look good.
Yeah. So, I don't know. I mean, do you want the product or do you want a better quality product? And, you know, even if it takes a little bit longer. I was waiting 10 years for a new Tool album. And when it came out, it still sucked. So, whatever. I love Lateralis, but I'm sorry, guys. The latest one was just, not that great. Right. How long do we wait for new Star Wars, and how did that turn out?
Oh, yeah, tell me about it. It hit all the right nostalgia notes, but after you kind of took a step back, you realized, oh, you know what, this isn't really that good. Yeah, or, hey, it's really the same plot.
Yeah. Or how long do we wait, you know, for, you know, well, how bummed were we when we found out that Season 8 of Game of Thrones was being split up? And then how did that turn out?
Ugh. I still want to watch that video that you sent my wife yesterday. She was listening to it.
Oh, yeah. I can't remember what YouTube channel that was. I think it was called The Dragon Demands. We're gonna go off on a little bit of a tangent here, guys. But the guy basically broke down. He got a hold of the original script for the couple of episodes of Season 8 that basically really flipped things around and changed things. And the main crux of it was that sort of the Mad Queen moment from, you know, the ending of Game of Thrones where Daenerys goes on a tear and just destroys King's Landing. King's Landing actually was not how it was originally scripted, and it's not what the showrunners told what's her name who plays Daenerys?
Amelia.
Why am I blanking? Who was it?
Emilia Clarke.
Yeah, Emilia Clarke. That's not what she actually was told. And I think, you know, a lot of us who have been astute readers and followers of the show kind of figured that, like, it would be a very George R.R. Martin thing for Daenerys to show up, start kicking everyone's ass, but accidentally set off a cache of wildfire, which destroys King's Landing. And that seems like a very Martin thing to do, a very, like, bittersweet thing. Like, you got rid of the tyrant, but you've still lost the city, and the fallout from that, even though it was a mistake. And it's actually, you know, Cersei's fault because she was the one, you know, with all the dragon, you know, fire, or the, sorry, all the wildfire caches, you know, that seems like that would be the way it would happen. And this guy, who does the analysis that really breaks it down.
I thought a good foreshadowing for the end was the Starbucks cup on the table, honestly.
Yeah.
It's all downhill from there.
Yeah.
No, I think the biggest gripe I had was with Jaime and Cersei. I honestly thought Jaime was going to kill her. That would have been made the most sense.
Well, and I think there are going to be the significant differences from the, you know, in the book, in the books, if they ever come out. But it it does seem pretty clear that, you know, Benioff and Weiss have no idea what they're doing, which is probably a reason why a lot of the projects they were sort of wanting to do at, and wanted to leave Game of Thrones as soon as they could for them, you know, so they could get on to something new. You know, I kind of get it. You know, it's been 10 years and you want to do something new, but they've lost those. Like the Star Wars thing they were going to do. Disney was like, nope, you're not allowed anywhere near what our IPs are because you're terrible at your job. I think there are a lot of things that will be different. And like, if I said like if the books ever come out, because I don't know, man, I don't think Martin really cares anymore. And I kind of get it that he doesn't care because he's made so much more money doing everything else versus being, you know, a starving writer and needing to put out material. Doesn't have to do that anymore.
The motivation's gone.
Yeah. And it's like, you know, there are serious concerns of, did the world Martin make, is it too big to fit into just two more books? You know, how many pages can you dedicate to all these characters that are perspective characters for different chapters? Like, can you hit all those beats? Can you dot those I's and cross those T's? How many do you have to kill to make space? And it just, it's been, like, what, 10 years, and he hasn't done anything. And even if he was writing just a few chapters a year, you know, he should be done by now. And I get it, like, he can make it, you know, it's done when it's done. But yeah, I don't know, man. Like, it's kind of hard not to be angry anymore or frustrated because it's like, if I knew he wasn't going to finish this, I wouldn't have read the books. I wouldn't have even started. I wouldn't have bothered.
Right. So what we're saying is we really hope that Ilclan doesn't take notes from season 8 of Game of Thrones.
Well, yeah. Yeah, well, I mean, it kind of, you know, it's sort of the same thing with Game of Thrones, right, the TV show. If we knew it was going to be that bad, if they were going to bungle the ending that badly, would any of us have bothered? You know, all the theory videos on YouTube and discussions, would any of it have mattered? You know, we wouldn't have done any of that because it didn't, it ended up not mattering at all. And so, you know, when COVID hit, did anybody out there say, hey, I'm going to rewatch all of Game of Thrones? Nobody said that because it wasn't worth doing. And I don't think anybody out there was like, okay, well, hey, now that Game of Thrones is done, I'm going to finally see and check out what everyone's been talking about. No, nobody did because they're like, this is terrible. So yeah, with Ilclan, it's like, come on, Catalyst. It's time. You got to stick this landing. So yeah, that was a bit of a long aside there, guys.
The Jade Falcons get the Terra, and they're the first clan there, and they just decide to take it easy and get into gardening. Oh, so, man.
Yeah, sorry about that, guys. I just kind of had to get that off my chest. Yeah, a little bit. I mean, I'm sure there are those of you out there who, you know, are on board with what I've said. Yeah. I mean, it's you know, not necessarily BattleTech, but you know, maybe a little bit.
Well, I mean, that's what happens if you don't want to wait. So it's like getting back on the Kickstarter. If we rush them, we're gonna get season 8. You know, it's like
we're gonna get season 8, but it's sort of like, okay, like talking about like back to Tool and Fear Inoculum. I mean, yeah, they were talking like, oh, we've had these ideas for years now. We could have done this album, you know, 3 years after 10,000 days. It's like, okay, well, why didn't you? Because it was still not that great of a product. And if, you know, you guys have listened to the whole album, I mean, there's a bunch of filler tracks that don't do anything. It's a lot of ideas on repeat for songs that sort of stretch them out and balloon them to kind of go nowhere. You know, so in the end, it's like maybe 25, 30 minutes of actual listenable material that have been like what, the movie 300? You know, if the movie wasn't in slow motion, you'd have like 15 minutes of movie.
Yeah. Yeah, I never really thought of it that way.
Yeah. So, yeah, okay. So, sorry about that, guys. That's just me kind of bitching about, you know, waiting on stuff and the slowness of products and releases. And, you know, it was just kind of, you know, for putting off the fact that we were going to do a part three of the clans and sort of the why Alexander Kerensky is a not great person, but still haven't spent the time reading the books necessary to, you know, put out that episode.
Yeah, it's just been rough to find time. You know, I went on vacation for a week, and I swear I probably slept a decent chunk of that just because of how tired I've been.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Chime in, audience, you know, in the comments and let us know, like, what your experiences have been lately. I think it's been, like, 2 months since we've done an episode. And, you know, work's been hard. You know, yesterday at work for the morning wasn't even that busy, but I think I vegged out all of yesterday and a good chunk of the day just recovering from the rest of the week. And I'm looking at my Monday surgery schedule, and it's going to be just about the same. For those of you who have not been able to work, I mean, this is by no means a slight against you guys. I mean, if you are service industry workers and you're in a state that hasn't reopened yet, or you're in a state that has reopened and you're fearful of getting COVID, or if you're in another country and fearful of getting COVID, you know, what's it like been on, what has it been like on your end? So good times. That's quite a downer. But I mean, not to leave it on that note.
What was your idea you had for this outside of our woodworking project?
Dan and I both live in older houses, and I was reglazing windows. For those of you guys who are not in the know, and by no means is this knowledge that I just intrinsically knew, this was knowledge I had to come across because I made the decision to not only buy an older home, but to buy an older home with its original windows, because that was a really nice feature. And so, you know, my house is like just under 2,000 square feet. And in the U.S., you know, for the house that was built at the time when it was, that was a pretty big home. But, you know, now you can buy newer construction homes for, you know, that are like 2,500 square feet, 3,000 square feet. You know, McMansions that are much bigger. But, you know, my house has, you know, more than 40 windows. And so, you know, doing that restoration project is a lot of work. When I was reglazing windows, which is when you've got your wooden frame window or your sash, and you take your sash and you have the glass sitting in the wooden sash in a rebet, with glazing points to steady it, and then you're putting in glazing putty to seal it. And I was just thinking to myself, like, this is probably what, you know, BattleTech would be like. You know, up into the 80s and 90s, you know, a lot of, you know, windows were still wooden windows, and they were held in place with glazing putty. And, you know, glazing putty would be made with calcium carbonate, which is basically chalk, and linseed oil to make the putty, and you pop that in, you wait, you know, 2-3 maybe even more weeks to wait for it to skin over, and then you paint it. If you get a new window or new windows, it's probably double or triple glazed. It's got some sort of inert noble gas like argon in between the window panes, and it has an advanced adhesive and sealant to prevent the argon from leaking out. That's great if you've got advanced construction materials and, you know, chemistry, and you can synthesize these adhesives and you can make this glass and you can get access to the argon gas. But eventually, those adhesives do fail and the argon gas leaks out, and then you've got condensation in between the panes, and then you don't really have that insulating barrier. And what you've got is actually probably worse than, you know, a well-glazed window and a storm window. And it made me think, you know, what happens in the Succession Wars if you're on a rough and tumble planet or, you know, not one of those core worlds with advanced access to construction? You're probably seeing things very similar to, you know, a lifestyle very similar to like the 1950s and maybe even the 1800s with advanced technology on the side. So like maybe you've got a fancy coffee maker, but you've got wooden windows that you have to reglaze every 15 years and paint over. And I was just like, that's a really interesting dichotomy. And yeah, I don't know. I mean, if that makes sense to you guys out there, that makes sense to you, Dan.
Well, that was the old aesthetic that BattleTech used to give, you know, future of the 80s, but it was like a deteriorated 80s.
Yeah.
It's like how, I don't know, like what, you get into thinking, like, what kind of storage media did they use? What kind of computers did they use? And if technology really deteriorated that much, I mean, I'm sure, like, the knowledge to produce such things, I mean, it was there, but if the materials aren't available or, you know, it's that beat up where you're basically like Mad Max scrounging for parts. It makes sense.
Yeah. I mean, your best friend would probably be someone who's a machinist who has that equipment that can, you know, make things very cleanly, and then use those things to make tools. You know, I don't know if we would be seeing, you know, I guess the question is like, do you see a world with like really fancy equipment? Like, do you see table saws or do you see, you know, things made by hand again? Do you see, you know, wooden planes and the, because making a wooden hand plane is very, very difficult. You can use different methods, but like the traditional wooden hand planes, or if you were a pattern maker for, you know, using beech to make a wooden pattern to then make a master of, to then make molds of for metal, that takes a lot of skill. Because if you think about it, you know, if you're in the future, you know, are you going to be able to use your 3D printer? Does that go away because you can't get the resins? Because you can't necessarily get the software and the equipment to use a 3D printer? Sort of things. And then you think about it too is, okay, you know, say you're a planet that makes windows, like window sashes with advanced stuff. Okay, like who's going to want to ship that? Because that, you know, are there better things to ship on your drop ship than windows? So a lot of things are probably going to be made on planet.
You think they're going to reglaze the windows on that Union eventually?
Well, hopefully that Union's going to be using like transparent aluminum windows, like Star Trek. Kind of crossed my mind. Like, I mean, those of you who, like, if you live in an older style home, these are things you're probably going to have to be good at. Things you're probably going to have to see. And I, for a while there, I thought like, oh man, do you see a return of lead paint? For a brief moment, and then people remember, oh, right, that's what lead paint does. See a return of oil-based pigments and just like linseed oil. Because all you need to do to make linseed oil is, you know, flax seed, and you squeeze it out, and then there you have it. It's almost more of a homesteading kind of thing.
Well, when I think of BattleTech, when I read a lot of the fluff or even through the novels, I always thought of it as, I mean, each planet might have different technology levels to it, but most of them, to me, kind of had a, like, Wild West kind of feel to it, which, you know, you're getting into talk about windows. I mean, with the way, like, some planets could be, who knows if they even had windows on some buildings? Because, I mean, there are... You could have, think of like all the like border periphery planets, you know, that have, like, pirates everywhere, you think people are really going to have time to sit there and do things like reglaze windows and, you know, upkeep buildings? I mean, it... I always kind of like the... Like, when they say Mad Max, I always think of, like, a Wild West kind of aesthetic for the game. Or yeah. Something like feudal, you know, like back then, like Dark Ages. You'd have, like, your blacksmith in town and stuff like... Not, like, a literal blacksmith, but I think you know what I'm getting at. There's, like, yeah. certain trades that are going to be valuable for that planet.
Yeah, yeah, I think those who have skills like that, it's probably very valuable, and they would be really kind of highly sought after. So yeah, it's one of the, like, I was thinking about it too, is you look at, like, history, right? And you look at, say you wanted to pick up a book that maybe cataloged, you know, arms and armor from sort of the Roman era, probably not too hard because Rome gets a lot of attention. But if you want to go earlier than that, there's a big gap between classical Greece and Alexander the Great, and then it jumps all the way to Rome. And there's plenty of evidence, plenty of stuff that's been dug up archaeologically that you can use to catalog things. But you're not going to find a book that really collates it. So then you think, okay, I'm in university. I've got access to, you know, JSTOR or the other libraries. I can look up all this stuff, all these articles, no sweat, right? So you start pulling them up, and you start looking up things on archaeological finds, and the vast majority of it are going to be on, like, it's going to be fucking pots, man. It's going to be pot shards and, like, what they found in this amphora, and there's not a lot in terms of military things. It's going to be, we found this pot shirt, and it had this writing on it, and, you know, it can be kind of a downer if you want to do stuff with, like, the military. But now, of course, now we're in BattleTech, right, where everything's so focused on fighting and battle mechs. But here you sort of think, okay, what would it actually look like to actually live in that world? It's just not something that I think is really discussed too often. And I just sort of think about it. Yeah.
It's a lot of fans have different interpretations because the new miniatures, I mean, getting back on, like, the new stuff, it's almost like they want to change that aesthetic.
Yeah. You know,
they want to go for every planet. It's just another way to, kind of like we were talking about the new aesthetic for the miniatures, you know, just everything becomes lumped together. It all becomes the same, you know, and it's like we're moving from some planets that are lucky to have working fax machines to, okay, now everybody has, like, advanced hologram, like, computers and, you know, internet is everywhere now. Like that kind of stuff is readily available, you know?
Oh, yeah, like, Star Trek Picard broke my heart because how bad it was. And that's a whole other, like, 3-hour rant if we want to get into that. But it's just sort of like you saw, like, these really elegant lines and these displays in the next generation, and of course there were some limitations with you know, 90s production, but then you sort of contrast that with these, like, really clunky looking ships, and yet everyone has these holographic displays. Because it sort of looks cool. It's sort of futuristic, these holographic displays. Oh, my God. Can you imagine the eye strain? Like,
yeah.
I'm 35, guys. I cannot imagine looking at a holographic display in front of me for hours on end. Like, that would be miserable.
Everyone's doing Tony Stark jazz hands, you know?
Yeah. Oh, God. Awful. Awful. Awful.
Yeah, I think we had the discussion too, you know, even when it comes down to, like, then we have the discussion about coolant vests, like how stupid people thought it was, like the sea mech warriors, like, basically about naked in their cockpits, but, like, people, they're like, oh yeah, it's better to wear something, which is true. Like, it's better to wear something because it'll actually like keep you cooler opposed to like, you know, being down in your boxers. But it's like, you guys couldn't think of something like Under Armour. You had to go with like these real generic looking fatigues and just like apply it to everybody so it looks like it's Call of Duty and mechs or something. Yeah. Like, why couldn't you just keep like a happy medium with the old way? But then again, it comes down to it. You think some planets are going to be able to make Under Armour?
Right, right.
Probably not.
Yeah, I think that there's definitely, you know, what is the meat and potatoes of Battletech? And that's why I think it'd be cool to do a whole episode sort of looking at the old examples of artwork and then looking at, you know, similar examples that would have inspired those artists, whether it was, you know, science fiction covers from the 70s and 80s, for books and illustrations, and, you know, bringing that stuff in. But, yeah, I mean, okay, so like, not every character has to have a mullet. Okay, we can get rid of the mullets, but, you know, the meat and potatoes of the world, I think, is really important. And I just, again, they're thinking, like, okay, what is it, what do you buy when you want a chair? I mean, do you get some plastic extruded thing? One, I mean, you have to be able to make the plastic, and maybe you don't live on a planet that can make the plastic, but, you know, making iron to make tools is probably something that can be done because you can machine the metal very easily and then using that to make something out of wood. So, like, maybe you see a return of, you know, wood siding, you know, a lot of wooden chairs. You know, you're not going to see a lot of press board and veneered stuff like an IKEA kind of things. Like, you're going to see
future IKEA.
Yeah,
that's IKEA. An interesting thought.
Yeah, there's a really cool yeah, there's a really cool book called How to Make a Chair from a Tree, and it walks you through how to get a tree, how to split the wood, how to bend it, how to shape it, how to cut the joints. Like, I imagine you're probably going to see a lot of that stuff.
Yeah, I think that's a, I don't know, I almost feel like it's kind of dangerous what they're doing when they go back and, like, retcon things. And I mean, I understand it. There's some things that actually do need some updating, but, you know, they're kind of treading between the line of, do we want this to be different, or do we want this to be modernized to the point where it's no different than any other war game we have out there? Which is probably a good reason why the rules have stayed the way they were for so long.
Yeah.
You know, like,
yeah.
When you look at the rules in Battle Droids or First Edition, all the way to where we're at now, not really anything has changed. You know?
Yeah. The changes are relatively minimal. Yeah.
Sorry. I was starting to talk over you. I was going to say, like, the only thing that really changed was everything post-Clan Invasion, which was part of the tension before, you know, the clans arrived. Like, they were just starting to get themselves, well, not really necessarily out of the hole with the Helm Memory Core, but, you know, certain technologies were starting to come back, and that's why there was so much tension when the clans came right away, because it was just the, all the planets that they took over had, like, nothing. You know, a majority of them. Like, Porthos, there was one warrior that actually, like, there were no defenders on that planet, and there was one warrior that actually came out of retirement to challenge, I think it was the Ghost Bear Sakan? Might have been Connor Sakan. I don't know, one of them from Alpha Galaxy. And that's how they actually defended the planet. It wasn't this big battle like every, you know, Battletech book tries the paint, you know? At least the newer ones.
Yeah. Yeah, going through, because I know a lot of, there's like a breakdown of conflicts by world. And it was maybe one of those things where it's like, you know, a lot of original, you know, Battletech stuff is maybe a little bit too detailed for its own good. But, you know, there is a breakdown in the Jade Falcon source book, the Clan Wolf source book, and then the Invading Clan source book for the other clans. You know, breakdown almost like by planet in terms of what things look like. But then again, you know, a lot of the guys who, wrote those books were big fans of, you know, the Civil War and other military matters, and so that's what their frame of reference was, and they ran with it.
It's just interesting to think, like, one guy coming out of retirement on a planet, like, what was going on? You know, like, why would it was a Draconis Combine planet, but it's like, what was actually going on Porthos that, like, nobody was there? And it makes you think, like, going back to your comments about technology and having to reglaze windows and, you know, making your own chairs and things like, you would think, like, on that planet, if they only have one person who was ever in that military, you know, or at least, like, the last person from the military who retired on that planet, like, what were their means of production? You know, how did they handle food on that planet? How was housing on that planet? How was the economy, you know? When it comes down to just, like, one person defending it.
Yeah, I mean, it's probably a lot of, you know, there's probably a couple of people who are very skilled at doing things. And, yeah, I mean, you're probably seeing, you know, blacksmithing and, you know, joiners and I mean, I don't know if you'd see timber framers. I mean, if you're going to build a house, like, what would it look like? Would it be timber framed, or would it be, you know, how a lot of houses are built today, you know, with joists and hangers and other fasteners? I think you probably would see a return to a lot more, you know, stable stuff that you can rely on for a very long time. You know, like for me, you know, at the clinic, you know, my dad built the veterinary clinic in 94. And I'm at this point where I'm seeing a lot of the cabinets having, you know, failures where sort of the hardware is. You know, you have these, the drawer sliders, and then you have the cabinet face, and the aluminum that, you know, holds the face onto the sliders is breaking. You think, okay, you know, is there a better way to do this? That's not going to be the case. And I imagine that over time, you know, with BattleTech, you know, Succession Wars hit, and you've got 250 years of just things going down the tubes, you're probably seeing, you know, the development of methods and materials that are going to be, you know, not pocket screws when you're making a box or a drawer. You're going to be seeing probably dovetails. You might see a return to hide glue. Because, again, you know, man colonized these planets, and so you're probably seeing, if there's not native versions of trees, you're probably seeing imported trees like pines and oaks and cherry and stuff like that, you know, just because. You know, I think one of the reasons why the Lao family was so successful at the beginning of the Capella Confederation was because I think the planet they were on had a bunch of, you know, either imported or domestic livestock that they could sell, because I think the planet was mostly grasses. So they brought in what they needed to do to be successful.
Yeah, I mean, even if, you know, worst case scenario, the planet falls off the grid somehow, you know, they have to at least be sustainable on their own, too. So you might see a lot of those old methods come back.
Yeah, because, you know, if you guys want to glue something together, I mean, you have to basically chemically come up with essentially, you know, PVA glue or epoxy or like a polyurethane glue. But if it's not going to be exposed to the elements outside, you could probably use hide glue. Because all you need to do with hide glue is just basically put a bunch of animal skins in a crock pot for a couple hours and then strain it out. And then the collagen that's in the water is your hide glue. You just let it dry, and you crush it, and you've got granules. And then you're set. So there you go. Now you've got glue. And you didn't need a chemistry set to make it. You just needed a pot and some water and some animal skins. So you do wonder, okay, are you going to see a return of that kind of stuff?
I don't know, some planets you might be able to make flatbread a lot better than normal bread because it's the atmosphere is different, you know, than like what we know on Terra.
Yeah.
You might have different, you know, cooking methods. Man, you could really get into it when you start thinking of little details like that.
Right. So if you're like role-playing, I think those are things that you can kind of consider and bring in. Or if you're storytelling, you know, what does the universe look like? What does it look like on a ground level? And again, like, you don't really see that in stories because it doesn't really matter. I mean, we read BattleTech because of, you know, the mech combat. You don't, you know.
You're not really thinking of everything else, but then you got weirdos like us that actually sit down and be like, hey, you know what? That's actually interesting to think about.
Yeah. Because if you wanted to make, to kind of come back to Windows, and, you know, if you wanted to make, you know, a good Windows sash, I mean, like, there are actually factories that showed how they do it. And I think there's one guy, he was on PBS. What's his name? Why am I blanking on everything today? But, you know, he basically goes to an old Windows sash factory and shows how they do it. And you can make, you know, these factories, you know, they basically power them with, you know, windmills or a water mill, and then these, you know, leather bands that run on these drive shafts that basically power all these tools. And you've got cutters that can basically be made from tool steel, and you can do all that by hand to make that cutter, and then you just run it through everything, and then you're set. You've got your window. It'll cut your profile, cut your cove for your mating piece, and then you're good. And then you just got to glaze it and paint it, and then you're set, and you've got a window. You don't need, you know, really fancy tooling in factories to make, you know, aluminum or vinyl, and then these advanced adhesives and a source of argon gas, you know, to fill it, to insulate it. It's just a different method of doing things that I think we're not really familiar with, because we don't have to do that anymore. But what happens when you do?
We should probably link that. You sent me a video before about that family, was it in Ireland, that makes scissors? That'd be a pretty good example for this, too.
Oh, yeah. I think I did send it to you. Yeah.
Like the whole process, like, they're expensive, too, but it's just because of the amount of labor they put into it, because they're using high-quality metal. They're using, like, you know, heat methods, they'll, like, shape it and everything. They're using, what is it, like a, I don't think it was, like, sandpaper, but something grit. Maybe it was, you know, to, like, sharpen it, like, perfectly to the point, like, you can, I don't know if they did it in there, but, like, you could probably hear it even by ear, like, to know if you actually had it, like, cut right. Like, that's the amount of skill that the family had when it came to making these things. You know, something to where, like, something as simple as, like, sound, they would know that they actually did it right when they put it all together. But, you know, thinking about, yeah, I should probably link to that video. I should dig it up and find it again.
But that, yeah, I'll see if I can find the other stuff I mentioned. Yeah. Yeah, so I do remember sending that your way. Just, like, how was it done? I mean, especially in the industrial era. You could, a lot of that stuff, you know, a lot of really, really good tools that have lasted, you know, the centuries, you know, they're made because they're made by people, even in a factory setting, who are really good at what they did. Mm-hmm. You know, I have a No. 8 Stanley joiner plane that, I mean, I don't know if I don't think there's a serial number on there, but it's probably over 100 years old. And all I needed was a replacement blade for it, and it works great.
Yeah, I don't have any fancy tools. I mean, I got an old key machine in my garage. A really old key machine that Diebold made. I don't think it's one of their originals, but one of their first, like, motorized ones that's still around. I mean, shoot, do you think some of these old planets have old Diebold-looking vault doors with the engraving on them and the glass with all of the, where it's like church glass, you know, inside of it, old-school brass combination locks? And
I mean, if you were probably on, like, one of the major planets, you could probably have something like that. Like, you know, mm-hmm. like New Avalon or
Hey, Time Fox can make a comeback if he can't have a security system.
Yeah. You got to think, okay, what's going to be... I think one of the limitations is what can be exported and what can be made on planet, you know? Do you spend the time and money to ship a fancy vault, or do you spend the time and money to send over the equipment that can make, 100 vaults, that kind of thing?
Mm-hmm. Yep, some people are, I wonder how they moved them back then. It's like horses and... Because a lot of the buildings that these vaults are in, man, like they put the vault in first and they built the building around it. I mean, you can, I think they did it in downtown Joliet. It was that First Midwest Bank when they demolished that building. The last thing they took out was that vault, man. They had to demolish everything around it and then they pulled the vault out of it in the end.
Yeah. 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 And I'm sure it was a lot of work to get that vault out, too.
That thing was beautiful, too. I think it was a Herring Hall Marvin from, the 1900s.
And
it had a lot of the original parts on it, too. Old glass and everything.
Do you know what the city did with it? Did they just, pitch it and, scrap it?
I couldn't tell you. I have no idea. But I know a lot of... usually what happens is... Like, a bank will buy the building, but they don't actually own it. Like, a landlord actually owns the building. And they, depending on the size of the door, I'll have service calls. Like, I just had one for a place way up north. It was a hobby store. I wish I could remember off the top of my head. My memory's not doing as well like yours today. But I had to do work for them. He just wanted to use the vault door again, and he still has all the old safe deposit boxes and everything in it. And he got that. It was like an old Western-style building. Like, you could feel, like, when you walk on the floors, like that old raggedy, Western, building feel. You kind of know what I'm talking about. And, all I had to really do was recombo it, but, the condition was still fine. And then, you go in the basement, and there's, another vault door down there, because it's, a vault on top of a vault, but what I was getting to was, in that basement, when the guy got the building from the owner of the building at the time, he purchased it from him. The guy, I don't know how he did it, but he actually took the door off and took it with him, the one in the basement. And he has no idea how he did it either.
Jeez.
I mean, he had it's possible. But, a lot of these things end up in, machine shop, scrap yards, where you can, and I kid you not, you could go on eBay and you could look up Diebold vault door and you can even find some on eBay for, up to between, $5,000 to $20,000.
Man,
you could move them. Sometimes I get curious. I've bought a pallet of safes from someone before, and they're a foot and a half by a foot and a half, and I've refurbished them and sold them, and I've carried them by hand and threw them in the back of my truck. you're usually just anchored to the ground, but those big vault doors, man. Where there's a will, there's a way. You can move them.
Yeah, I just imagine, hopefully you don't have to go up or down any stairs.
No. Well, that guy had to. That's why I'm I don't know how he did it. I have no idea. But he freaking took it with him.
Yeah, I suppose, when it comes to, let's say vaults, right? I imagine, it depends on what resources are on the planet, too. What kind of steel do you have access to, and what kind of compromises do you have to make? Mm-hmm. And that, like the katana, for example, the katana really is, it's a series of compromises because of what poor quality iron Japan had access to, and then how they kind of worked around that. I imagine, depending on where you're at, if there's not a lot of iron in the crust of the planet, do you you're probably relying on other materials to do things.
Back to the Bronze Age.
You have to import a lot of stuff. Yeah, it's just sort of, again, like, stuff you don't think about. You don't really have to think about, but I suppose if you were making an RPG environment, these are things that you would be thinking about. Like, okay, what does the world look like that I'm living in? And I suppose it's one of those things, if you were to ever live in a world in which there might be a Battletech movie, you know, what does that look like? How do you capture that feel? Because, you know, I don't think it necessarily would be, I think on some planets it would be definitely Mad Max. You know, there's a great PDF only product, and I can't remember who commented on it, but it was basically, I think it was on the Tortuga Dominions, and, you know, it's okay, you know, one of the pirate powers, and you think, basically what the guy said, and I think was it Weirdo over on the boards, but you go in, you know, expecting, like, Pirates of the Caribbean, you know, like, yo-ho, yo-ho, a pirate's life for me. And you end up reading the supplement, you're like, oh my god, this whole thing was like Witness Me, Mad Max, Fury Road, you know, cover to cover. You know, you don't really expect that, but it's there.
All I want to do now is see the Doof Warrior on the, like, top of a battle mech just blasting his damn guitar. I guess he ran the Snord recruiting him for that.
Yeah. This poor dude. Bobbing up and down underneath the chin of the Highlander mech, speakers blaring it out. actually, you know what? I bet a Goliath would be a good choice for a mech like that.
Yeah,
you replace the LRMs with speakers.
All the clan elementals are like, witness me!
Yeah. It'd be interesting. So, planets that are, like, late 19th century, early 20th century lifestyles, you know, juxtaposed with, you know, advanced battle mechs and other advanced materials, and then you've got that next to planets that are very Mad Max-ish, you know, roving bands of warriors. You've got, I mean, because I know, I think it was in one of the Avanti Angels books where they go to Astrokazi. I think one of the few times we actually were on the planet Astrokazi, you've got basically like Bedouin tribes and nomadic tribes, you know, working its way through the canyons of the planet. And you see that sort of lifestyle. And then you see maybe the more advanced, you know, futuristic science fiction lifestyle that you would see on, you know, a major, you know, wealthy planet.
New Avalon, you know,
yeah.
Era.
So, yeah, I mean, I think we kind of talked there for quite a bit, over an hour now on things like that. So just kind of wanted to get that off my chest. You know, what would life be like? And I think on a good chunk of planets, you'd probably see something, you know, very similar to, you know, 20th century, early 20th century life, you know, where, hey, if you want to take care of your house, you have to know how to glaze a window and paint a window, and you have to know how to nail boards together. And, you know, maybe you... There's a dude down the street who's, you know, putting together, you know, stick chairs and splitting wood to make chairs versus, you know, just going to an IKEA and getting something.
I don't like IKEA.
Yeah.
I never really did.
Yeah. Yeah.
I don't think you can get an Oscout to navigate through IKEA.
No, you get lost. Well, I mean, they have those arrows everywhere, so that you don't get lost, but, you know, you still. Yeah, that's enough rambling on my end. I don't know, was there anything else you wanted to say, Dan?
No, interesting topic. You actually caught me off guard with that one. And it kind of goes with, you know, the silly little hex bases I've been making, because, you know, we're making all of them. I'm making all of them out of wood, man.
Yeah.
Just take my sweet time with it. I've even gotten to the point where I'm making little dice now to go on it. Everything wood and paper.
Yeah, I'll see if I can track down, you know, those videos, sort of those relevant videos that show kind of that stuff, you know, what they would do and how they would do it.
Do like a, you could do like a pinned comment, you know, so people could check them out.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, if you want to put this up, Dan, I'll start looking some stuff up, and I'll get a comment that you can pin for me. We can kind of go from there.
So, yeah, that was episode 6, 7, one of them.
Yeah, something like that. Something like that. Yeah, I had to break the silence there and get something out for you guys to listen to. And, you know, who knows? I mean, maybe the next one will be a little bit more planned out and thought of. But it just, the idea struck me, and we hadn't had a chance to do anything. And, you know, something for you guys to think about out there. Whoop, sorry, my cat is knocking things over.
I got my door closed. My cat can't come on me.
Yeah, something for you guys to think about, you know, when you look around and you consider what things were like. There's a really cool book by Lost Art Press. Let me see if I can find it quickly so I can get you guys a title. But, you know, basically, I think it was Woodworking in Estonia. And, you know, this book is a reprint, or I think a translation, of the original. And, you know, it's the examples they use, they are not, this is not from, you know, hundreds of years ago. Here it is. Woodworking in Estonia. Roy Underhill. You know, he's the other guy. He's the guy I was talking about with the window factory. And Roy Underhill had a show on PBS that was pretty brilliant. But, you know, basically, you know, this Woodworking in Estonia, it was put together, I think, in the middle of the 20th century, that sort of broke down how things were done in Estonia by craftsmen. And it uses and describes, you know, various tools and how they did it, how they would hold the work in place, what their workbenches looked like. And oddly enough, their workbenches actually match very closely examples of ancient Roman workbenches that we see from, you know, artwork. So, just kind of cool stuff. Like, I imagine things would look that way. And this stuff is not that long ago, you know, us using all the power tools that we use now, like, that is really, really recent stuff. I mean, people making pots, people making dishes, making utensils, making everyday objects that you use. How would it be done? What would it look like when you don't have access to modern factories? And you don't have access to populations to support those factories.
That's why we have a cattle master.
Yeah. Yeah, I hope when you edit this, you're gonna put up that image of the cattle master.
I'll put up the cattle master. Actually, I'll make a nice collage of all of the some of the industrial mechs, the silly looking ones.
Yeah, all the quad mechs and everything.
By the way, this is episode 7.
Okay, cool. cool.
Yeah, welcome to episode 7. We're leaving now.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, hey, you guys take care. Stay safe. Wash your hands.
Wash your hands.
Wear your mask.
Don't be like Florida.
Yeah, don't be like Florida.
All right, cool. Stay safe, everybody.
Yeah. Signing out, guys. Bye.
Bye.